This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 4, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Palestinian children defy curfew as school reopens. Haitian refugees remain in INS detention even though the INS acknowledges their low risk. And journalists could be forced to testify at the International Criminal Court. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Secretary of State Colin Powell represented the United States today on the last day of the United Nations World Summit on Sustainable Development.
We have unveiled at this conference four new signature partnerships in water, energy, agriculture, and forest. These programs will expand access to clean water and affordable energy. They will reduce pollution, provide jobs.
Security guards removed 13 people, jeering the Secretary of State, shouting, "Down with Bush." Large contingents of global environmentalists walked out in protest of what they term the corporatization of worldwide policy. Naeem Jinnah reports from Johannesburg.
Powell came to Sandton only for the last day to do what the U.S. government does best at these occasions: give speeches, refuse to answer questions, and don't make any real commitments. U.S. NGO delegates were angered that George W. Bush didn't come to Johannesburg himself and that his representatives were continually obstructionist, refusing to agree to targets and refusing to sign the Kyoto Treaty. Most of the international organizations like Oxfam and Greenpeace, as well as South Africa's social movements Indaba Coalition, have declared the summit a failure. Most civil society representatives agreed that the WSSD was a summit of the rich for the rich. Some said there was more talk about trade and bolstering corporations than about alleviating poverty. Meanwhile, it's unclear when tonight South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki will give his closing speech. In Johannesburg, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Naeem Jinnah.
Congressional leaders were summoned to the White House, and there was an announcement that British Prime Minister Tony Blair will visit the U.S. next weekend. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
This administration will go to the Congress to seek approval for necessary to deal with the threat.
The president welcomes Tony Blair to Camp David this weekend and plans to address the issue of Iraq in front of the United Nations on September 12th. But Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights refutes the administration's claim that post-Gulf War ceasefire violations give the United States the right to strike Iraq in the first place. Ratner notes that under the UN Charter, the United States still must gain the approval of the Security Council before attacking. As for the rationale behind a military campaign, this morning's meeting with congressional leaders offered no new information supporting such action. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said this was because the purpose of the meeting was only to reassure Congress that they will indeed be consulted on the matter. At the White House for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The NGO coalition supporting the International Criminal Court, or ICC, accused the United States of trying to undermine the United Nations treaty written to bring some of the world's worst human rights abusers to justice. Heather Risby has more from the UN.
A coalition of NGOs and legal associations that worked for 7 years to establish the International Criminal Court held a news conference today criticizing the United States for pressing other countries to enter into what they called illegal contracts to avoid possible prosecution of U.S. nationals by the ICC. Since the establishment of the court on July 1st, the United States has been trying to approach governments around the world to sign agreements allowing immunity for U.S. peacekeepers from the jurisdiction of the court. The NGOs also criticized the British government for being soft on the Bush administration's move to sign such agreements. The British government is trying to convince the European Union to understand the U.S. position, but so far it has failed to gather any support for the U.S. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
Finally, over 10,000 of Boston's union janitors and maintenance workers are preparing to strike this evening as deadlocked negotiations with building management contractors continue. Thatcher Collins has more from Boston.
Boston's Mayor Thomas Menino initiated a new round of negotiations today over pay raises and health benefits. The Service Employees International Union wants to increase the proportion of full-time work and give part-time workers health care. The union voted to strike on Saturday when summer-long negotiations failed to replace the now-expired contract. If a strike begins, it would start gradually with specific buildings chosen at random in order to prevent counteractions by building managers. Teamster unions who pick up garbage and deliver packages to the same buildings will not cross picket lines. The 1,000 buildings facing strikes are many of downtown Boston's most prominent and profitable buildings, including City Hall. The union is holding a march through downtown early this evening. Thatcher Collins, Free Speech Radio News, Boston.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Back from their visit to the White House, congressional leaders say they're happy President Bush will seek congressional approval before attacking Iraq. But while Democratic Senate leader Tom Daschle says he'd still like to know more about the White House's plans, Republican Minority Leader Trent Lott says he could have a bill on the Senate floor by the October congressional recess. Meanwhile, the Defense Department is downplaying reports of heavy arms shipments to the Persian Gulf scheduled for later this month. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington.
Fresh from the White House this morning, Democrats and Republicans said the president gave them no new evidence that Iraq has or will soon have nuclear weapons. But Republican Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott says the U.S. could still act on its own to topple Hussein.
It's really down to some very limited numbers of things that he needs to get access to have, in addition to chemical and biological weapons, nuclear weapons. So while there may not be a threat from Iraq or an attack looming, there is a serious problem here.
Iraq contends it has no weapons of mass destruction program. Secretary of State Colin Powell says that's nonsense and calls for U.N. weapons inspectors to go back into the country. The U.N. pulled its inspectors out of Iraq when, in 1998, U.S. espionage compromised the inspectors' mission. Vice President Cheney says inspections would do no good. Inspectors or no inspectors, President Bush says Hussein has to go. The president will deliver a highly anticipated speech to the United Nations on September 11th. Democrat Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle says the administration is sending mixed messages.
I think he said by the time he speaks to the United Nations, it was his view that on this and many other questions, the administration would speak with one voice. I don't know what that voice will say with regard to weapons inspection.
Israeli officials say they're preparing for a U.S. attack on Iraq within a few months. The Reuters news agency says the U.S. Navy is planning to send its third shipment in a month of military hardware to the Persian Gulf. The Pentagon says that's just routine. Michael Donovan with the Center for Defense Information in D.C. says that may be true, and stresses any war on Iraq won't just happen overnight.
The Pentagon and the administration is talking about 225,000 troops, and that kind of run-up is going to take approximately 3 months. It wouldn't surprise me if the Pentagon is trying to increase their stocks of material and munitions in the theater, although this in itself need not indicate and probably doesn't indicate that an invasion is imminent. This stuff happens routinely, but even if this is not routine, they're certainly going to need several months more of preparation.
Donovan says there are probably some 30,000 U.S. and allied troops in the Persian Gulf area already. Other outlets say it could be more than 100,000. President Bush wants Congress to vote on a resolution to attack Iraq before the October congressional recess. Some centrist Democrats say they wouldn't vote for it today. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was scheduled to meet with lawmakers in a classified briefing on Iraq this afternoon. Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich hosts a forum on the alternatives to war with Iraq. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Ariel Sharon said today that the U.S. will give prior notice to Israel should they attack Iraq. Sharon added that, quote, Israel is the most prepared country if an attack should take place. Meanwhile, two Palestinians relocated by Israel from the West Bank to Gaza Strip today have asked to be transferred to the International Red Cross building in Gaza City in order to be under international protection rather than Palestinian jurisdiction. This is IDF reservists refusing to serve in the territories asked a Supreme Court to rule the Israeli occupation of those areas illegal. And as Awad Duwabes reports from Ramallah, as school began this week in the occupied territories, children face many obstacles, like the Israeli-imposed curfew, just to get to class.
Last Saturday, 1 million Palestinian children started their new school year. This year starts with heavy memories from the last 2 years of the Intifada and the hope and determination mixed with fear of the future. Dima Saman, head of the Public Relations Department in the Palestinian Ministry of Education, summarizes the last 2 years of casualties in the education system.
We paid a very high price. 246 students were killed and 2,610 students were injured. Most of them had very severe injuries and they will stay forever handicapped. And the occupation closed 7 schools by military command, and there were disruption in 850 other schools. 197 schools were shelled, 25 schools the Israelis broke into, and they transferred 3 schools as military bases.
Saman explained that some measures and emergency plans were implemented to ease the life of students, parents, and teachers. She said the ministry tried to place teachers in their own neighborhoods to avoid more than 300 Israeli military checkpoints located across the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Even though curfew was lifted on the first day of school, the story was different on the second day. Israeli patrols reimposed curfew in Ramallah, Jenin, and Hebron while students were at classes. School principals had to decide whether to send the students back home or just continue with their day. Ibrahim Hjazin, head of a private school in Ramallah, explains.
We decided to continue school in spite of the curfew because we have to start. If not, we shall lose a lot. This year we have less students because the students in the villages outside of Ramallah cannot come easily here.
Nevertheless, Hjazin emphasized that schools had to be more flexible and ready for any emergency case, a day or a week curfew or closure, for example.
We prepared 3 programs for the school. One, the classic one, for every day when we are free. Second, when there is emergency in the day itself, we have program for 5 periods, just only, not 9, most important subjects. And when there are curfew, for example, many days, like last week or before that, okay, we prepare home program for the children to do it at home, and then we shall discuss it with him at class in the school.
Students across the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, like Mira Haddad in Ramallah, say they are too scared to study. Mira Haddad is in the 11th grade.
I thought, what will happen now if they came and say, you have to close schools, you have to go home, you are in order not to study. So coming here to school is so hard to us, and I feel so afraid, so bad inside of me. I hope to come to school and to be this situation so calm and free to know how to study. But I think that we have to fight for our peace or for our studying and for free.
This is Awad Abis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
The appeals court at the UN War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague is considering opposing arguments by prosecutors and some of the world's largest news outlets over whether journalists should be compelled to testify. The court has ordered a retired Washington Post reporter to appear as a witness in the case of a Bosnian Serb accused of genocide. The news groups supporting the Washington Post want the court to outline procedures exempting journalists from testifying. They claim this would set a precedent for the new International Criminal Court, which is set to start handling cases next year. Geraldine Coughlin reports from The Hague.
Journalists are divided over the issue of whether they should testify in court. Some claim it compromises their objectivity. Others regard it as their duty. Dozens of reporters have given evidence voluntarily before the tribunal. The latest was Jackie Rowland, the BBC's former Belgrade correspondent, who testified at the trial of the former Yugoslav president Sloboda Milosevic, who questioned the impartiality of the BBC.
Did you report about the other consequences of NATO bombarding? Did you tour the
towns and cities throughout Yugoslavia which were bombarded by NATO, civilian targets, hospitals, schools, buses, trains, moving trains, columns of civilians, people on bridges. Did you report about all of those things, Ms. Rowland?
We reported broadly on all the various things that were hit by NATO bombs, yes.
Jonathan Randall is the first journalist to refuse to testify at the tribunal. Prosecutors argue that his evidence is essential to the case of the former Bosnian Serb Deputy Prime Minister Radislav Brđanin, whom he interviewed in 1993. But the Washington Post claims that forcing journalists to testify could endanger their lives, those of their sources, and make news gathering in war zones more difficult. Judith Armata of the Coalition for International Justice feels that an exemption for journalists could deprive the legal process of critical information.
Journalists are often the ones that first, and sometimes are they only witnesses to see what happened. They're very important witnesses. It's part of their role there. And so to rule that information off bounds really leaves a vacuum. It really, for the courts, it's important information that could go a step farther into bringing to justice some of these criminals.
Radosa Milutinovic, a journalist with a Belgrade-based Beta news agency, thinks that reporters should enjoy journalistic privilege, the right to decide for themselves whether to testify or not.
Otherwise, I think we are going to see a situation in which journalists are going to think in advance about the consequences of their work and to impose some kind of self-censorship on themselves because of fear that they might be subpoenaed or summoned before the court.
International media groups want the tribunal to establish a qualified privilege for reporters that would exempt them from subpoenas. They expect the appeals court's decision in the Randall case to serve as a precedent as to whether journalists should be compelled to testify before the new International Criminal Court, which is set to begin handling war crimes cases worldwide next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Geraldine Coughlin at The Hague.
This week, the United States Senate is debating how to implement the so-called Homeland Security Office. It's expected that all or part of the Immigration and Naturalization Service will fall under this new branch of the U.S. military. This comes as the INS and FBI continue to detain unknown numbers of immigrants. Last December 3rd, the U.S. Coast Guard found 181 Haitian refugees in a 31-foot boat just off the Miami shore. 9 months later, about 120 still remain in federal immigration detention centers. The INS says the lengthy detentions is because the refugees are a high flight risk. But as Shannon Novak reports from Miami, the INS has actually classified these detained refugees as low flight risk, making the INS in violation of its own federal law.
Before being put into an Immigration and Naturalization Services detention facility, detainees are given what's called a detention standard. That's a classification system based on their criminal record, the possibility of them harming someone or themselves, and their flight risk. Will they show up at their INS hearings? A detainee's classification is not public information. But according to an INS law, the color of the detainee's jumpsuit and the wristband that they wear coincide to their classification. Attorneys and paralegals who routinely see the Haitians who arrived on December 3rd say that they wear light blue, the INS color for a classified low-risk detainee. So then why, after 9 months, are these people still incarcerated? Rodney Germain is with Public Affairs for the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
It's to discourage illegal maritime traffic.
But I'm assuming if it's a policy of the United States government, it's in writing somewhere, right?
I mean, it's a policy change that was passed down from headquarters and above. I don't know exactly where it originated.
The reason why Mr. Germain doesn't know where the policy originated is because no one can seem to find it. For 2 weeks, this reporter and the INS searched for the so-called new INS policy towards maritime arrivals. It appears as though this federal law has never been documented. Again, Rodney Germain.
Well, the policy shift from December has basically been in respect to the parole of Haitians arriving by maritime. And, you know, the point is that they're trying to discourage illegal smuggling, risking lives unnecessarily to try to get to the United States, you know, by all means.
It all seems to make sense until you look at the INS Cuban Immigration Act. The same problems with illegal human smuggling, the same dangerous voyage, the same type of unseaworthy vessels. But this, quote, new maritime policy, one that the local press is starting to call the INS secret policy, doesn't apply to Cubans. Cheryl Little is the executive director of the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center.
They've been transferred to remote facilities where not only can they not find lawyers, they can't even find anybody who speaks their native language. It's a pitiful record, and it only seems to get worse. Post-911, you'd think that our government, and in particular INS, would be focusing its time and its resources on targeting terrorists. You know, instead, we're spending tens of millions of dollars detaining Haitians who have nothing to do with terrorism and who have a legal right to pursue their asylum claims in the United States of America. I mean, this is the land of the free. You know, we're always talking about due process, and yet we look at a group as vulnerable as the Haitians. I mean, it's very clear that, you know, all hell is breaking loose in Haiti.
The Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center, known as FIAC, filed a federal lawsuit citing INS discrimination against Haitians. The judge ruled the matter was not one of the courts, that it is up to the United States Senate to manage INS law. The case is now in appeal. Florida Senator Democrat Bill Nelson.
The administration needs to apply the immigration policy fairly and equitably to the Haitian refugees, instead of having a double standard where they're treated one way and locked up and can never get out, and others are treated the opposite way.
The INS says that they are trying to prevent a mass exodus from Haiti. Essentially, they are holding the December 3rd refugees to let people in Haiti know that their chance for asylum in the U.S. is unlikely.
There was an adjustment to the policy, but people in Haiti, they were not told about the adjustment. No, nothing from the government, from the United States government to the people of Haiti. Even I couldn't find out what was happening. So how does somebody else, especially if they don't speak English, know what's happening?
We're talking about risking your life to come into the United States through an illegal manner, putting your life in the hands of a smuggler who doesn't care about anything other than making money.
Wendy Young is the Director of Government Relations with the Women's Commission for Refugee Women and Children.
I do support rescue at sea, but what we're doing here is we are interdicting people and we're returning them to political conditions that are very unstable without any scrutiny of their refugee claim. They may be trying to send a message back to Haiti, but chances are that's not going to work. The young woman we spoke to, for example, saying she will leave again. If they were truly about saving Haitian lives, what they would be doing is doing refugee processing in Haiti so that people never had to get on those boats to begin with. Refugee protection is about saving lives, not interdiction and detention.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Novak in Miami.
And finally, when the extreme rightist Jean-Marie Le Pen made it to the finals of the French presidential elections, he said the French had shown they would rather have the original than the photocopy. The campaign debate centered around crime and delinquency, Le Pen's battle cry. The centre-right finally won the presidential and parliamentary elections on a platform of restoring law and order. The French Interior Minister, who intends to be tough on immigration, recently made a trip to New York City to find out about former Mayor Giuliani's zero-tolerance policies. This after visiting Romania last weekend to prepare a voluntary repatriation for illegal underage Romanian delinquents. Nick Champoux has more.
France has recently uncovered a series of networks organized in Romania by traffickers who either force immigrants into prostitution or recruit disabled people to beg on the streets. The French government estimates there are 2,000 Romanian minors in the streets of Paris and Marseille. Antoine Majou from the Parada organization is attempting to help them.
Most of them are living in the street or in squats. They came from Romania to work and to make money in Paris and in France. And at the beginning, they used to steal the money from the parkmet, and now there is less money in these boxes. They have to prostitute themselves for some of them or to steal some money.
And how old are they?
They are from 12 up to 20 years old.
And where are their parents?
Most of them have their parents in Romania. And their argument in Romania is to say, anyway, in our country, we have nothing to offer to them.
Mafia networks arrange transit for many of these children. They are promised a Parisian El Dorado, but in reality, they are prey for prostitution and begging networks. France wants to return the Romanian illegals to their home country in the run-up to what the French government calls a voluntary repatriation. It will look after the underage Romanians and promises they will be properly looked after once they return home. Valentin, a Romanian who established himself in France after the fall of the Ceausescu regime, doubts this will be the case.
I don't think it's very easy today in Romania to take in charge a lot of people coming back from France. You know, there is a big problem in Romania with all the children who don't have any family. We have government and the state has a lot of problems, and I do not trust that all the money gonna arrive in good hands to the people.
As far as the French center-right government is concerned, what matters is that law and order be restored to reassure French public opinion, meaning no more Romanian beggars on French streets. Daniel Davis is mayor of a suburb south of Paris, where hundreds of Romanian gypsies have established themselves.
Ils impressionnent beaucoup de monde, bien entendu, par la situation. C'est ainsi que
a lot of people here are concerned. A certain number of gypsies have to pick through the trash to survive. Of course, there have been many thefts. We also have a big mafia in this town which encourages disabled people to beg and then collects the money. Two members of this organization were arrested last week. The question is, can a city like mine accept such a situation? Certainly not.
The solution proposed by the French government to clean up city streets singles out Romanian gypsies, who'd rather be called Roms. The Romanian Prime Minister, Adrian Nastase, supports a proposed idea that Romanian gypsies apprehended in France should have their assets frozen to discourage illegal activity on French soil. Critics say he didn't have much choice but please his French counterpart. France is Romania's strongest ally in the country's bid to join the European Union. Meanwhile, the wide media coverage harmed the way the French perceive the Roma community. Only a minority was involved in the mafiosi networks. The odds are they will be even more discriminated against when they return back home. Sainir Mile is a Roma who studies international law in Paris.
In a moment when Romania is hoping to integrate the European Union, and when Roma are the first thing that Western people see from Romania, well, even a politician, a Romani politician, he declared on 29th of August that our Roma are silly. They are circulating all over Europe with their dirty clothes and they ask for money and so on. So they make us feel shame.
The French Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy is planning to sign more bilateral agreements. He will soon be heading to Mali to introduce similar voluntary repatriation programs. From Paris for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nick Champeau.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.